Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. So was that a fire truck? Is that what that was? That was quite a play of sensations there. I thought about all of us listening, and I'm not sure I shared this story before, but I was once leading a retreat with about 75 people, and this was at Kripalu Center in Western Massachusetts. In the summer, all the windows were open. And there were some volunteers who were pointing the bricks outside, you know, knocking out the old mortar and putting in fresh mortar. And, of course, we're all in silence in this 45-minute retreat. And these two guys were talking. And I'm not making this up. This was pretty much the conversation. So, dude, you think I should call her? Dude, you should call her. You know, dude, I think I'm going to call her. Dude, you should call her. On from there. And I just sort of peeked, and I saw everyone was listening. Everyone was sitting like this. So all this shared experience here. Jack Kornfield shares a story, and he wrote about in his book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry, the story of Ajahn Jumnian, who was a monk from the jungles of the Malay Peninsula. And he was brought to the West to teach through a translator. He didn't know any English. Well, he knew two words of English. So everywhere he would go, he would like open his arms and smile and say, empty, empty, happy, happy. That was pretty much his whole repertoire and all he really needed, I guess, for his talks. But he would talk about how all things, life is like a dream. And just like a dream, everything changes. And just like a dream, nothing in your dream can be possessed. And so all conditions, things change, and when you can recognize that inherent emptiness, what can arise is a quality of happiness. So I thought I'd share a little bit about that. And as always, I usually break my talk into four parts. So part one will be happiness, part two will be happiness, part three will be emptiness, and part four will be emptiness. So a little more specifically, first on what is it that blocks your capacity to be happy, and to talk a little bit about two fundamental kinds of happiness, and a little bit here on emptiness. What does emptiness mean? There's some real misconceptions about that. And then what's this dance of cultivating emptiness and happiness? How does that actually work? So I was leading this teacher training, and there was a beautiful woman there from Japan who at her graduation told a story, and I'll call her Akiko because that's her name. And I don't think I'll do the story justice as to how she told it, but she talked about living in Tokyo when the big tsunami hit. And she was working at a trading desk in a large office building in Tokyo, you know, with the stocks and so forth. And so when the earthquake hit, you know, everyone is trained. So she got under her desk, you know, with everything she needed. And she was trained since she was a kid. She had been through many earthquakes before. You know, you have your essential materials. You always have your shoes with you in case you need to run. But this one was really big. And she thought, maybe I will die this time. And then in the midst of, you know, all of the shaking and the trauma and everything you can imagine, being in an office full of people under your desk, she heard something that sounded like ocean waves. And she realized it was the yogic breathing that she had learned in her training, that she was breathing slow and full and deep and smooth. And then she thought, well, what do I want? And then she thought, I don't want to die with these people. This is not my tribe. And her tribe was really, you know, people who are on a spiritual path. She wanted to die with people she felt she had a real connection with, and people who want to be more awake in their lives. So after the quake, she had to walk home, and she met a man on the street who had a compass, you know, who were able to find their way through a lot of the rubble and destruction. It took her 6 hours to get back to her apartment. But when she walked with this man that she had met on the street, they talked about what they would do if they survived. And she said, I want to teach yoga and meditation and help people to be more free in their lives. And that's what she did. And she left Japan and she came to the States and kind of dove into her training. And she talked about how great it was to be in the United States in a non-quake zone where she could sleep with her shoes not right next to her in case she needed them, and didn't have to worry about what foods had radiation in them, and not having to wear a mask because of all the dust and so forth. And she shared this with one of her teachers there, and her teacher said, well, have you ever told your story? And she realized that she hadn't. She realized that she hadn't felt worthy to tell her story because so many people had died and so many people had suffered, and she wasn't entitled to acknowledge, you know, her own trauma. So during this program, which had a lot of intensive meditation, she went to bed feeling really happy and feeling really good from a long day. But then she woke up around midnight with something close to a panic attack. And she thought, well, what do I do about this? And she remembered the practice, which we've talked about here a lot, to recognize what is happening and to ask if it's okay to be with it, and then to investigate, to actually lean in and look closer. And she could feel a tightness in her chest. And she could feel that kind of that aching trauma of being afraid that she was going to die. And she was able, for the first time in a long time, to actually bring some tenderness to it, to bring some empathy to it. And she felt something shift inside. And then she said, so, well, what is happening right now? She was living in a dorm, and she said, oh, I'm in the bottom bunk. Someone next to me is snoring, and I'm safe. And she was able to fall asleep again. I love that story because for Akiko, it took that moment of asking yourself, what will I do if I survive this? To help her to clarify what she really, really wanted. And in that clarification, she made a pretty dramatic life shift. And we all have to ask ourselves, well, what would we want to do? What would you want to do if you would survive today and have tomorrow and the next day perhaps to live? And what that generally requires is when we look at what it means to be happy, we have to be really honest around what's between us and being happy. What's between you and being happy in your life? That honest assessment is really, really helpful. Sometimes it's brought upon us through some kind of a crisis, some wake-up call. Either your life is in danger or someone close to you dies, and it can sharpen up that reflection of what's most important in your life. But what I loved about Akiko is that she heard that call to recognize, I'm not happy in my job, I'm not happy with this tribe. And now she's pretty darn happy. She's a pretty happy person. And I think when it comes to getting clear what happiness is, many people don't really know. But we have some intuitive sense of what it is because we know what it isn't. And oftentimes when I ask people, well, what's between you and feeling happy in your life? They can pretty quickly mention some things. A wonderful exercise I found, a great exercise, if you're not really clear about what you want in your life, get a sheet of paper with two columns, and on the left-hand side, write down everything you don't want. That's can be pretty easy. And then write down the opposite of that in the next column, and that'll start to indicate the qualities that you're really called to. If you don't want to work for someone, well, maybe you'd like to work for yourself. If you don't like being told what to do in your job, maybe you need a position where you have more freedom and more autonomy. If you don't want to feel guilty in your relationships, well, then what you really want is to cultivate a sense of freedom in your life and in your relationships. So that can be helpful. And it's important. An important distinction is recognizing that there are really two kinds of happiness: the conditional and unconditional. A little while back, I got my Social Security overview. I guess I'm that age, you know, where they say, this is what you made, and this is what you're going to get, and all that sort of thing. I hadn't got one before. And so I looked it over, and there were like maybe 13 or 14 years where my income was zero. And I remembered, of course, that I had been a member of a vowed order for those years. So I hadn't paid anything. I didn't receive anything either. But I had a vow of poverty and was a member of a vowed order. And I was making $28 a month for about 8 years, and then they bumped it up to $35 a month. I remember having dinner with some friends from college, and they were talking about the money they were making and how hard it was. And I said, yeah, I make about $400. And I could just see the wheels turning, like, can't be an hour. A week? I said, yep, $400 a year. When I moved in, if you had more than $100, you were supposed to give it to the ashram. And I was not ready for that degree of surrender. So I did have my $3,000 from my resettlement allowance from the Peace Corps. So I said, happy birthday, Dad. But I remember, as the years went by, that I had that $3,000. And I remember thinking to myself, if I just had $5,000, then I'd feel a lot more secure. And then when I started making money, I started saving money, and as soon as I hit the $5,000, well, suddenly it went to $10,000. And then it just kept on increasing. The bar kept moving. And I'm sure maybe you've noticed that in your life, the sense of like how much is enough. The bar just keeps on moving because we have this sort of conditional sense of what's going to make us happy. And so it's an interesting reflection. In fact, let's do a short reflection. If you like, you can close your eyes. If you like, you can deepen your breath. And if you would, just reflecting back, when was the last time you were really, really happy? And you might broaden that just to think of maybe three times in your life when you felt really happy. And just to, as best you can, either recall those times, or if you can't think of any, you can make one up. And is there a sense of what happy feels like inside when you think of those memories? And another question, was there something outside of you that resulted in you feeling happy? Was it conditional? And when you feel like, you can deepen the breath. And if you'd like, you can open the eyes. Hopefully, you could find a happy memory or two. And perhaps in that experience of happiness, there was, perhaps many people report a feeling of ease, a feeling of maybe gratitude and warmth that may be part of that. There's a quality of happiness that has to do with contentment. A sense of, this is enough. And you could say that happiness in many ways is the absence of desire. But it's also helpful to recognize that one form of happiness is conditional. That once you get the next iPhone, then you're going to be happy. And so much of our life is set on conditional happiness. The terms that we have set up that will result in us being happy. But a lot of what this practice points toward is it possible to cultivate a quality of happiness regardless of the externals? That's where the practice opens up some new possibilities. I've been thinking about people who I know who are really, really happy, and pretty much my mind just went to like babies and puppies, you know? But then I wondered, does that just come from ignorance? Or is it possible that to be happy knowing everything is going to change? Is it possible to be happy knowing that your body's going to get sick? And you're going to get old and die. Can you be happy knowing that all conditioned things are going to change and fall away? That's that second kind of happiness that we can develop in ourselves. A happiness that is not dependent on externals. There's a story, this guy who finds a bottle. You know, I thought just for the fun of it, and he'd rub it. And Jeannie comes out and says, you have one wish. I will grant one wish. And the guy's just sort of paralyzed. And he says, look, could you come back tomorrow and let me think about this? You know? And Jeannie says, well, that sounds like a wish, but yeah, I'll come back. And he comes back the next day, and the guy says, I'm not ready yet. I need another day. So this goes on for a couple of days. And finally, the genie comes back a little impatient and says, look, I really need your one wish. And the guy says, I realized I was coming up with all these things that I wanted. And finally, I realized that that each of the things I wanted was something that was going to make me happy. So I'm just going to ask for happiness, and that'll take care of everything else. In this particular frame of teachings, happiness is described as your true nature. That who you are in the absence of wanting, who you are in the absence of pushing away, who you are in the absence of confusion, is this quality of happiness. There's also a teaching that says that who you are in your true nature is also a quality of emptiness. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what does emptiness mean? I had a pivotal moment in my meditation practice once. I was just doing my practice, trying to be as self-aware as I could, and I began to feel a sense of dread inside. And I, you know, it may have been associated with someone who I knew who had died. That may have been part of it. But it was also kind of open to kind of an existential dread. And it felt like a really, the dread. I remember saying to myself, this feels like emptiness, but really bad emptiness. Which set up a question of like, well, what's good emptiness? And then as I sat with that, I thought, you know, I've had moments of what I call good emptiness, of just feeling spaciousness and feeling ease and like not desiring anything other than what I have, and yet the moment feeling utterly fluid. And then I remember asking myself, what if it's not good emptiness or bad emptiness, but what if this is emptiness? And something kind of shifted for me. There's something about opening to the unknown, where you are experiencing the moment without any labels, without any sense of good or bad. That points toward a quality of presence. Thich Nhat Hanh is a beautiful thing, where he says, if I am holding a cup of water and I ask you, is this cup empty? You will say, no, it is full of water. But if I pour the water out and ask you again, you may say, yes, it's empty. But empty of what? Empty means empty of something. The cup cannot be empty. My cup is empty of water, but is not empty of air. To be empty is to be empty of something. This is quite a discovery. So emptiness is not nothingness. It doesn't mean that nothing exists at all. That's kind of nihilism. In the Heart Sutra, it says that emptiness is the true nature of things and events, but it's not some kind of heaven realm. The Heart Sutra says all phenomena in their own being are empty. That's not all phenomena are empty, but of their own nature is empty. So this gets a little bit heady. So I thought I might just lead a little meditation that might just sort of get a felt sense of what emptiness is. And to do a sound meditation, I brought along my bamboo flute. So if you like, you can close your eyes. I find sometimes sound meditation can be a very powerful practice. And you might begin just by noticing all the sounds you can identify right now. And you'll notice perhaps that there's a quality of listening which occurs through the linear rational function of the brain, where your mind will identify the source of the sound. It'll give a name to the source of the sound. And there's another quality where it'll identify whether that sound is of danger or not. It's a natural filter or lens for listening. Another way of listening in Zen is referred to as bare attention. And that is, rather than listening through the mind, you're actually opening to the vibrations of the sounds, the sound waves, without a label. And you may notice that there is a space in which the sounds arise and take form and fall away. Can you sense or imagine that space? And with the sound of the bamboo flute, you might just notice the vibrations and shifting tones, but also to be aware of the space between the sounds, the emptiness that is filled with sound vibration. in the play and the sounds of shifting forms, can you imagine or sense the silence behind all of the sounds? There's a quote from a Zen teacher, Brad Warner, who says that emptiness in Buddhist terms does not mean nothingness. It means that every single thing we encounter, including ourselves, goes beyond our ability to conceive of it. We call it emptiness because nothing can ever explain it. Reality itself is emptiness because we can't possibly fit it into our minds. So if you like, you can deepen your breath. If you like, you can open your eyes. So in the teachings on emptiness, it can be somewhat confusing. But I find with the sound meditation, it's such a helpful metaphor because you realize that when you really tune into sounds, first you notice that they're changing. And that's the first characteristic of reality, that conditioned things change. And the second thing that you notice is that they're not personal. They're just passing through. And that you are the one who is aware of all the changing forms. And when we can expand that in our lives to recognize that the thoughts and beliefs and sensations and moods and emotions are also like changing forms, there can be a greater degree of contentment, and that can point toward a greater degree of happiness as well. So I remember once back in the community where I lived, we had a program called the Inner Quest Intensive, and it was 3 days. And this was back when it was pretty nutty. But you would give up your car keys and your phone. Actually, the people didn't have cell phones back then. And all the brothers would sleep on the floor in one room, and all the sisters, all the women would sleep on the floor in another room. For those 3 days, your meals were... you didn't know when the meals were coming, but they're pre-prepared for you. And in that, we would do really intensive practices. And we'd do intensive meditation. We'd do deep breathing experiences. We would do bioenergetics, where you kind of like stress the body. And one of the culminating experiences were you would be with a partner, and you would be saying everything that you never said to your parents. As you can imagine, take away people's food, their car keys, have them sleep on the floor, for 18 hours a day. People are pretty primed. So we would have, when people would experience like strong emotion, they just raise their hand and ask for a bat, and they would bring them a wiffle bat, a plastic bat, and then they would pound and kind of let it out, and. Then we also had a mattress where you could work out your aggression on a mattress. So the whole idea was here, we get really activated and just let it go, let it rip. And I remember this is one of the more intense intensives I've led. But at one point, in a room of maybe 75 people, or maybe it was more than that, there were 13 bats going, with people yelling. There were two guys working over the mattress. And one guy had bloodied his knuckles, and this was like before we knew about AIDS, but there was like blood. someone stood up, screamed, started running for, this was a staff person, screamed, started running for the door, was tackled by one of our staff people. In the midst of this cacophony, I thought, I am happy. It was an exquisite moment to be in the midst of that incredible. Of course, that was what people were there for. I mean, they were there to really do the work. But in the midst of that capacity, in the midst of that, to be happy. And I think that becomes a question we really have to ask ourselves. In the midst of the full catastrophe of your life, is it possible to pause and say, yeah, I'm happy right now? When we practice meditation, and again, I think of meditation as cultivating non-judging awareness. And that is, you know, we use an anchor such as the breath or sound or feeling as a way to bring ourselves here. But then when you're here, it's opening up that sense of what does it mean to be awake to your life without judgment? And what you begin to experience is the flow of your life. That includes your undigested experiences. It includes your desires, your fears. All of that is kind of on display. And I remember something that I believe I've shared before, but it's something Joseph Goldstein said after doing a 3-month retreat. And I have a lot of respect for Joseph Goldstein. If you don't know him, he's a brilliant, brilliant teacher, one of the primary Western teachers of Buddhism. So when he does a three-month retreat, and he kind of summarizes his learning, I really listen. He said his big takeaway was, anything can happen at any time. That's true in meditation, and it's true in life. Anything can happen at any time. And so it brings up this question of then what is happiness? We can think of this happiness as a state of non-desire. It's saying yes to what is here. And when you say yes to life, sometimes it's when the conditions are right. Conditional happiness is a wonderful thing. You get what you want. The question is, can you cultivate happiness when things aren't going your way? This doorway of gratitude and appreciation can be so powerful. There's a beautiful reading, and we'll close with this as a final meditation. And this is a Tibetan reading that talks about happiness. And it really points toward how you can open to cultivate unconditional happiness. How you can cultivate your capacity to be happy no matter what the externals are in your life. So if you like, you can close your eyes. And imagine this coming from a wise Tibetan monk. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower. It is already present in open relaxation and letting go. Do not strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever momentarily arises in the body-mind has no real importance at all. Has little reality whatsoever. Why identify with it and become attached to it, passing judgment on it and yourself? Far better to simply let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves, without changing or manipulating anything. And notice how everything vanishes and reappears magically, again and again, time without end. Only your searching for happiness prevents you from seeing it. It's like a vivid rainbow which you pursue without ever catching, or a dog chasing its own tail. Although peace and happiness does not exist as an actual thing or place, it is always available and accompanies you every instant. Do not believe in the reality of good and bad experiences. They're like today's weather, or like rainbows in the sky. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this tight fist of grasping, infinite space is there, open, inviting, comfortable. Make use of this spaciousness. There is nothing to do or undo, nothing to force, nothing to want, and nothing missing. Everything happens by itself. If you like, you can deepen the breath and you can let the eyes open. So I've been trying to get my own handle on this happiness thing, you know, what it means. And I really find for myself to think of happiness as non-desire. When you're not wanting, just as this Tibetan monk described it, when you're not wanting, you relax. And when we relax, you open. And in that openness, there is a spaciousness that can occur, where you can sense the space that emptiness which is not nothing, that holds the mystery of this whole life. So all this talk about unconditional happiness, just a moment of conditional happiness, I think we do have cookies. So back to conditional happiness. Thank you for your time and attention. There's a mindful discussion group happening. It's right across.